From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from a local respiratory therapist who describes caring for COVID-19 patients. Then a local COVID-19 survivor shares her experience battling the illness and her message for others as the virus continues to spread.
Those little things, they have a ripple effect, and I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Plus, we learn how gerrymandering in Wisconsin could be impacting the pandemic response.
You're seeing a state legislature that is willing to sue the governor over masks. The result of this is citizens don't have a voice.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The coronavirus pandemic continues to surge in the U.S. Health experts have advised people not to travel for Thanksgiving this week or celebrate with anyone outside their household. Some states and local municipalities have put restrictions similar to those we saw early on in the outbreak back in place as hospitals are becoming overwhelmed with patients. Respiratory therapist Niu Tao knows firsthand what it's like to work in those conditions. The MATC graduate volunteered to work at a hospital in East Orange, New Jersey, when cases began to spike there earlier in the pandemic. East Orange is a suburb of New York City and one of the hardest hit areas in the nation. Tao spoke about her experience back in July, and we'd like to warn you that some descriptions are graphic and may disturb some listeners. So set the scene for us. What were things like there when you first arrived?
When I first arrived, it was pretty busy. There were a lot of positive cases of COVID-19 and a handful of admissions all coming at once. It was a bit overwhelming. Lots of coding, cardiac arrest, people not surviving, lots of deaths. So pretty scary time.
What was that like? I mean, you know, you said you had about a year of experience. Had you seen anything quite like that?
No, never before. Before taking on this assignment, I was at Children's Hospital, and there, you know, maybe once a blue moon you see a death, but when arriving to New Jersey, it was a very different story. Lots of sick patients with cardiac arrest and not being able to save. Honestly, I've never seen so many deaths before.
Yeah. A lot of people here haven't necessarily seen someone with COVID-19, especially a very severe case like that. Can you describe what patients experience or what they looked like in these circumstances?
Yeah, definitely. You know, out there on the East Coast, a lot of the COVID patients that we were seeing were in extreme respiratory distress, meaning deprived of oxygen, not able to breathe on their own, breathing very fast and rapidly. The majority of them are being intubated, meaning having to have a breathing machine do the work for them. And a lot of times they don't make it back alive. The lungs are not functioning very well, and the machine is breathing for them. A lot of times they're extremely sedated and not alert at all. Lots of secretions.
When you say secretions, what do you mean?
Yeah, from what I experienced out there, our patients were foaming at the mouth. So basically, there was so much fluid in their lungs that with a machine breathing for them, we can only do so much as far as suctioning goes. The secretion is basically just buildup of fluid that is coming back out of their mouth. And so it's just been a lot of nonstop suctioning. and trying to get that out as much as possible. Very rare will you see someone make it out alive in a situation like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Because with all the secretions, it also affects the heart. When there's so much fluid backed up in your heart and lungs, eventually your heart is working so hard, eventually it gives out. And that's where you find the cardiac arrest.
How would you describe what a typical day looked like for you when you were working at the hospital?
Yes, in the beginning it was very chaotic. 1 minute there's, you know, two or three admissions in the ER, to running to the ICU to try to resuscitate someone whose heart has stopped, to running to another room to try to resuscitate someone else whose heart has stopped. We also draw blood to check oxygen levels, so we were doing a lot of running around for that. It was hard to hear, because the PPE that was provided is not your average PPE. It is, you're wearing a respirator mask along with a goggle, a face shield, a white suit, T-VEC suit, that covers your ears. It's very hard to hear what others are saying or trying to communicate to you. So you really have to pay attention, be on your toes, and communicate effectively. So it was very hot, hard to breathe. Every round that I would complete, I would just be completely drenched in my own sweat. It was rough.
Wow. You know, it sounds like something you'd see in a movie of, you know, a pandemic, which of course is what we're in.
Yes.
When patients came to the hospital, were you able to take care of everyone? Were there lines? Was everyone in a bed?
Yes, for the most part they were. And if the bed was not available, they were in the ER waiting for a bed to be available. But also we were separating non-COVID patients from COVID patients. And with the COVID patients, if the room was big enough, we would put two or three or maybe even four patients in one room.
Wow.
Yes, and I haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah. How did things evolve while you were working there? You know, you said at the beginning it was very chaotic. Did that get easier as time went on?
It did. Within, I would say, 4 weeks, I wouldn't say it started improving, but the admissions, the COVID cases, admissions were slowing down quite a bit. And then from there, we were able to care for our patients that are there currently without running around too much. So yeah, definitely the cases definitely slowed down and we were able to manage more as time went on, for sure.
You know, COVID-19 infections here have started to rise once again. Does that concern you?
It does. Coming from New Jersey and New York, I feel like some of the people here are not taking it as serious. I know when I was there for 8 weeks, everybody was wearing a mask, whether they're walking their dog or riding their bike or just walking around the neighborhood. Everyone was taking precautions. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with the severity of the cases out there. So that was the norm for the last 8 weeks. When I returned home, it was very different. It was kind of hard to believe that everybody is still acting as if things are normal. The truth is, restaurants have to open, businesses have to open. You know, we have to get back to living again. But I think this is the new norm, and everyone should still take precaution. And I think this is probably going to be the new norm for a long time.
As you mentioned, there are people who are acting like everything's normal, who are going about their lives, not wearing masks, not, you know, washing their hands incessantly as many others of us are. If you were talking to someone who is a skeptic, someone who doesn't think this is a real problem, what's a story from your experience that you'd want them to hear?
Yeah, I would probably tell them that this is very, very real. I've experienced it for myself. I don't know if you know, but I had gotten really sick. The first 2 weeks that I was there, I had gotten really, really ill. I wasn't sure if it was COVID or not, but I was running a fever. I was showing some symptoms, but I was in denial. I'm thinking I'm young, I'm tough, you know, there's no way I could have gotten COVID already. But I did collapse in the hotel elevator. And at that moment, I thought I was dying. I seriously had no idea what happened, but I know I blacked out and I hit my head, was bleeding. I was rushed to the hospital. Now, whatever that was, I survived it. They are assuming it is COVID. I took all precautions while I was working at the hospital and when I was at the hotel, and I still got sick. So I would probably share with them my experience among the experience that I faced while working at the hospital, and hopefully that will, I don't know, bring some sense to a couple of people.
Yeah. Well, Nu, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your experiences. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you. You're welcome.
Nu Tao is an MATC graduate and a respiratory therapist who has been on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. We spoke with her back in July. After the break, we'll hear from a patient who was hospitalized with and survived COVID-19. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. More than 12 million people have been infected with the coronavirus in the U.S. Back in May, when we spoke to COVID-19 survivor Danielle Nelson, that number was less than a million nationwide. Nelson was a healthy 37-year-old woman with no pre-existing conditions who was seemingly at a low risk for contracting coronavirus. Then what started as chest pains escalated to her being hospitalized and diagnosed with COVID-19. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski after her recovery in hopes that others can learn from her experience as cases continue to climb.
Yeah, so I started having chest pain around probably March 12th or 13th. And I didn't really think too much of it because these are crazy times we're living in. And I thought it was just anxiety. And so I kind of shrugged it off. But then on March 16th, I started feeling a little off in the morning. And then by the evening, I had a kind of a full-on fever. And so I pretty much did not leave my bed for the next several days until the afternoon of March 19th, when I ended up going to the ER to get tested. It was a really brief visit. They gave me a prescription for albuterol to help with breathing, which at the time I didn't need. So I went home, went immediately back to bed, and then, you know, really kind of took a turn for the worse. And so it got to the point where, you know, it was really hard to walk. I was resisting the urge to crawl, you know, to get around the house. So in the later afternoon of March 24th, I ended up going back to the ER and then was there until the 29th. And then was back home and have been recovering from home since March 29th.
And you are, you know, a young, healthy person, no pre-existing conditions, no history of smoking, nothing like that. It was unexpected, right?
Completely, yeah. I mean, when I look at the list of, you know, folks or conditions that might put me more at risk, I don't meet any of them. And so it was another reason I kind of looked past the chest pain initially, just because I thought, you know, I shouldn't really be at risk, you know, so maybe I could worry a little bit less, but that was obviously my mistake.
Well, and there's a lot of information being bombarded at us. So by the time you're admitted into the hospital, and this was before any tests came back positive or negative, correct?
Right.
So what was your experience like to be a COVID patient inside the hospital?
Being in the hospital with COVID was really scary and really isolating because, as you probably know, no one's allowed into the hospital. And so I was there by myself. And, you know, I've been messaging with someone on Facebook who is in the hospital now with COVID in a different part of the country. And she kind of compared it to being a zoo animal. And when I read that, I choked up because that was really my experience as well. You know, understandably, doctors and nurses are afraid. And I felt that very much so. And just having that limited contact was really scary when you're, you know, spending so much time alone with your thoughts. It's scary and hard to be the diseased one that everyone's afraid of when I'm afraid of myself as well.
Yeah. So how were you feeling, you know, levels of pain and stress physically feeling during the days you're at the hospital? I understand you didn't need a ventilator. You were having some difficulties coughing and those kind of symptoms, but you didn't need to be intubated, fortunately.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really grateful for that. I did receive oxygen and, you know, I think the thing I'm learning about COVID is that there's really a lot of ups and downs. And that was true for me in the hospital as well. I'd have, you know, times where I just, you know, I couldn't even make it to the bathroom by myself without calling someone in to help me. And I really wasn't able to eat. And then, you know, of course, being in a hospital, it's hard to sleep anyway, but, you know, having difficulty sleeping. But then, of course, there were moments that were a little bit easier. And certainly, you know, by the end, I felt like, you know, I was ready to go home, even though I wasn't even sure I was ready to go home. I was scared to go home. And even now being at home, there's good days and bad days still.
In your first Facebook post that you shared, sharing your story and that you were positive, you wrote about a moment that you prepared to say your goodbyes to your fiance and your mom. And I mean, I can't imagine that, but how was it to feel the need to do that, to feel like this might be the lowest point, this might be the end in a life that people assume has so much more to go?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to go back to that moment because I just love life and I feel like there's so much more that I want to do. And I think reflecting back now, it gives me a lot more empathy for other people who are in those moments because it's sad and it's scary, especially being there alone and not being able to really touch anyone and touch the people I love and tell them in person that I love them. You know, I kept getting worse and I kept thinking this, I can only get worse for so long. And I was, you know, hooked up to heart monitors. And when I went into the hospital, I was really dehydrated and had super low blood pressure. And so it's not that I wasn't hopeful that I would get better, but my body wasn't getting better and it was causing me to worry.
In the moments when you were awake and thinking and concerned and noticing how your body was feeling, in what ways did you try to cope with the pain? Did you find activities or thoughts or things that kind of helped you?
So I had a meditation app that I used, and that helped a little bit just to really help me focus on breathing and not panicking. I completely stopped listening to the news and went off social media and really tried to not look at anything about COVID-19 just because there's so much bad news and it would just cause more anxiety. And then I watched the movie Julie and Julia about 4 or 5 times when I was in the hospital because I was hoping it would spark a desire to eat. Because that was a big issue, is I just did not have an appetite and I only wanted to eat sugary things. And, you know, it didn't work, but it's a great movie. And now I know all the lines.
Yeah, it'll be a movie forever changed for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you able to FaceTime with your family, friends? Did you have the energy to?
No, and I did a little bit, but again, I was so out of it, you know, most of the time and, you know, just kind of dealing with my own demons, it was hard. And I know that you know, I wasn't looking very good. And, you know, just in that I looked really sick and weak, and, you know, I didn't want to scare my friends and family any more than they already were. So, mostly texting.
So you've been out of the hospital and are now technically cleared of that isolation period post-hospital. You know, you can leave your home, but how has your body felt since being released?
So just now I'm starting to feel a little bit back to normal, you know, in my body. I'm still tired. I still take a nap every day, which I had never done before. And now it kind of there's a still lingering feeling in my chest. And I kind of compare it to like going to a bonfire and maybe inhaling too much smoke and feeling it the next day, that kind of crackly, achy feeling in your chest. That's kind of how it feels. And some days are better than others.
So what concerns you the most being a survivor of COVID-19, but not really having any concrete answers?
I'm terrified of infecting someone else. You know, the thing that has been the most frustrating about having COVID is just how nobody knows anything. And people you expect to have the answers, like doctors, like public health officials, there's so much that they don't know. And so, you know, I've been cleared. They say that I'm not contagious, but now that I have a little bit of doubt in my mind, and I'm, you know, just mentally a little bit anxious about that risk, because of course the last thing I want to do is hurt anyone.
Why did you decide to share your story first initially online through your Facebook and now with us?
Yeah, well, so I wrote this Facebook post, and originally, you know, I had just written it to friends, and then, you know, my mom asked if she could share it on her Facebook page. So, you know, you do what your mom wants. So I made it public. And all of a sudden, you know, it just kind of blew up. And I think it's been shared like over 30,000 times now. And it's kind of shocking. But when I wrote it, you know, I had just gotten home, and, or, you know, that week, and I still was feeling so horrible. I was sleeping most of the day, and I felt so lonely. And, you know, I didn't really know anyone else who had the same kind of symptoms or who had had it quite as bad as I had gotten it, or who had been in the hospital. And so, you know, I think thinking about it now, I wanted to tell all my friends that this happened to me, but also I wanted to share my story because I wanted others to know that they weren't alone, that there was someone out there who had had, you know, a similar experience. And I kind of wanted to put myself out there. And that actually since has really helped, I think, in my recovery, helped me feel less alone, less isolated.
Yeah. How are you trying to take care of yourself now in post-recovery?
Yeah. Everyone tells me I need to keep drinking water. So I'm trying to do that and stay hydrated. I'm a little bit tired of hearing that, actually. And, you know, I like to walk my dogs around the block, you know, just that kind of basic recentering, stuff that I think can help everyone. But, you know, so many people have reached out to me with such kind things to say and kind of hopes for my recovery. And, that has helped me. And, you know, I had, someone, kind of an acquaintance friend from my alma mater, McAllister College, reach out to me, and who's an art therapist. And so I've been doing some art therapy sessions over video, and that has been really helpful just to kind of regroup after just feeling like I'm on another planet for the last 6 weeks or whatever.
So what's your call to action for everyone listening now and moving forward as many places across the US and around the world continue with extensions for safer at home orders?
I've thought a lot about this. And I think this whole situation with COVID has made me realize how connected we are and how much we can impact each other. And also how we can just do a little bit better by each other. And so maybe that's, you know, wearing a mask, even though it's uncomfortable and it's not perfect. Or maybe that's, you know, wearing gloves, or not going to the grocery store today and just eating that macaroni that you have in your pantry instead. Those little things, they have a ripple effect. And I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Since you've been home and having this experience, do you think that people aren't taking it as seriously as it should be warranted? Because they maybe don't have the connection, they don't know someone who's had it, and all they're seeing is the news of the worst of it, New York or other things, and it's numbers, it's not connection.
Yeah, I think with anything, hearing personal stories helps people understand things in a new way, which, you know, from that Facebook post that I had, I've been contacted by a lot of different news organizations to do an interview, and I haven't really wanted to, just because I don't necessarily want to be the face of COVID in Wisconsin. But you know, I chose to do this one because I'm a public radio nerd, and also because I think it is important for people to hear that someone actually has experienced COVID right down the street from them in Stallus. And I think, you know, that stories are what connect people to each other and I think make it more real for people. And, you know, a little bit, I'm hoping that's what my kind of opening up about my experience will do.
Danielle Nelson is a COVID-19 survivor who lives in West Dallas. She spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in May. Coming up, we'll learn how gerrymandering has played a role in coronavirus policies here in Wisconsin. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Despite the recent spike in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in Wisconsin, many businesses are open and welcoming masked customers. Governor Tony Evers recently extended a statewide mask mandate in hopes of slowing the spread of the virus. The governor has faced backlash from the legislature about his executive orders in the past, and this time is no different. David Daley says the sparring between Wisconsin's Democratic governor and its Republican legislature all leads back to gerrymandering. Daley is the author of a book on partisan gerrymandering, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about why the gap between public health recommendations and which policies are actually enacted is all about district maps.
How is it that COVID-19 cases and the positivity rate can be well above what is considered safe for businesses to be open in Wisconsin, but almost all places of business are still open?
That's a great question. And I think what you have to do is you have to look at the kind of public policy that polls in your state continuously show are popular, such as wearing of masks. You had a Marquette poll earlier this year that showed 69% of voters in Wisconsin favor wearing of masks, that it was across every region of the state. And yet what you are seeing coming out of your state legislature are really the opposite. You're seeing a state legislature that is willing to sue the governor over masks, a state legislature willing to sue the governor to force a primary election to take place in April. The result of this is citizens don't have a voice. And this is largely due to the lines that were drawn to keep specific legislators in power. This is gerrymandering. These are the districts that were drawn in Wisconsin after Republicans took over in 2010 that have really locked them in power regardless of what voters want to do. In 2018, Wisconsin voters go to the polls and they elect a Democrat to the U.S. Senate. They elect a Democratic governor and replace a Republican governor in Scott Walker. They elect Democratic candidates to every statewide office. And then they give Democratic candidates about 205,000 more votes for the state assembly than Republican candidates. That's enough to move exactly one seat in the assembly toward the Democrats, and Republicans hold on to a 63-36 edge. Let me break that down. That means with 53% of the vote for Democrats, they were able to win 36% of the seats. Your district lines in Wisconsin ensure that your state legislature is not responsive to voters. It's insulated from the ballot box. It's unaccountable, and it need not change, because a swing of 200,000 voters is not enough to change control. Lawmakers know this. They are able to behave in such a way as to be completely impervious to anything that the public wants, even if it's masks during a pandemic that 70% of voters back.
As we get closer to the election and the risk of the spread of coronavirus grows, how do you think politics will play a role?
I think that your state government has become completely disconnected from politics. Harvard's Electoral Integrity Project does a survey every 2 years of electoral boundaries. It's one of the many criteria in their election integrity report that tests the health of democracies. In their 2018 report, on a scale of 1 to 100, Wisconsin's boundaries got a 3. That is the worst in the nation. It's also the worst of any country in the world that is measured by the Electoral Integrity Project, and that includes authoritarian states like Venezuela, which at least got a 14. That is how unresponsive and unaccountable state government is in Wisconsin. The lines have provided them a firewall against the public will, and what you see again and again is when the governor has tried to bring them into session to do something that is popular, whether that is the special session on guns to pass background checks that 80% of citizens backed. They gaveled in and out in seconds. When he tried to bring them in on police reform, and this was even before the events in Kenosha, you had 81% of the state, according to the Marquette poll, backing a greater accountability for police misconduct. They gaveled in and out of that in seconds. When the governor tried to call a special session to force this legislature to do something about postponing an election at the height of the pandemic back in April, they gaveled in and out of that in seconds. This legislature does not care because it does not have to care. They have insulated themselves from voters. Wisconsin, as a result, more closely resembles an authoritarian state than it does a genuine representative democracy.
What are the consequences of having that level of disconnect between constituents and those supposed to represent those constituents?
When a majority of citizens cannot change their legislature, something has gone deeply and seriously wrong in a representative democracy. And that's what's happened in Wisconsin. You have a situation in which 53% of the people can't even budge the legislature that is supposed to be the closest and most responsive branch of government to them. That is dangerous. That is wrong. That is not a democracy. And when people can't repair their own representative government, it throws the legitimacy of the entire system into question.
Do you think people feel heard, that the power of casting a vote carries weight for the individual person in Wisconsin?
I think at the presidential level, an individual vote certainly matters. At the gubernatorial level, an individual vote certainly matters. You have seen how close those races have been.
You're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of votes in the Walker-Evers race, in the Trump-Clinton race back in 2016. So yes, at that level, your vote in Wisconsin is very important and matters and may matter more than, you know, I'm talking to you from Massachusetts today. You know, my vote in the presidential election doesn't matter very much in this blue state that we know how it is going to vote. But as far as your state legislature, no, that vote really does not matter. There are a lot of people who will say this is because of the geography of the state. A lot of Republicans try and defend this map by saying the map is not gerrymandered. It's simply that, you know, Democrats have been concentrated in Madison and Milwaukee, and Republicans are more effectively spread out across the rest of the state. There have been academic studies of this that have been litigated in courts that have shown that the actual geographic bias is maybe 1-2% of the bias in the maps. It is not the actual reason. The reason for the bias in these maps is intentional. It is partisan. It was baked into the system, and it has done serious damage to representative democracy in the state of Wisconsin.
How does gerrymandering impact the lack of action following the increase in COVID-19 cases?
Lawmakers simply don't have to listen to the public. These lawmakers know that they are insulated from the voters. So when 70% of voters want to see masks, they know that there is no reason to do that. If these lawmakers do not want to do something, they do not have to. And the other piece of this is that gerrymandering enables more extreme representatives. Because these districts have been so rigged for one side or the other, what you tend to see is the primary becomes the election in which all of the attention is. And primaries tend to be lower turnout, and they tend to be motivated by the most extreme elements of the base of either side. So you get the most committed liberals and the most committed Republicans. And as a result, the kinds of people who are sent to Madison to legislate are more extreme. And they are most accountable to that extreme base, because the voters can't actually turn them out in November. The party name next to their name is the most important thing. So as long as you have the nomination of the party that district has been drawn for, you are perfectly safe in November. The only thing you have to survive is the primary. And you survive the primary by being most attentive to the most extreme ideological piece of your party's base.
When does the need for public health action outweigh politics or the desire to either gain more power or hold on to it?
I think that the need for public health action ought to always be the number one concern of legislators. And what you are seeing in Wisconsin is that some sort of, you know, culture war over what a mask represents is more important to these legislators than health. And that is because of the way they have gerrymandered these districts to really cut out the vast majority of public opinion.
When you think about the political makeup of Wisconsin, gerrymandering, and the increasing risk of COVID-19, what change are you hoping to see, or what do you see that does make you hopeful at this time?
I think voters around the country really understand the dangers of gerrymandering. In 2018, you had voters in 5 states, including Midwestern neighbors in Ohio and Michigan, also Missouri and Colorado and Utah, that voted to rein in the ability of politicians to draw their own lines and choose their own voters. And this was widely popular. In most of those states, it passed with 60-70% of the vote. So it's Democrats, Republicans, and independents of these states really understand the importance of this, recognize that gerrymandering is cheating, that it debases democracy, and that it shouldn't be allowed. We're heading into another census year, and we redraw all of these state legislative lines again after the census year. So Wisconsin is thinking about the presidential election. Certainly, the state legislators you elect in 2020 will have the power to draw these lines. You have a Democratic governor in the state right now, and sometimes when you have both parties with a seat at the table when it comes to redistricting, you end up with a slightly fairer map. The governor could conceivably veto maps that come out of the General Assembly next year. That said, if that happens, they would likely go to a conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court. So I think the state of maps in Wisconsin probably is going to remain in fairly dire shape, at least into the next decade.
David Daly is the author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and other books on partisan gerrymandering. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how gerrymandering can help explain the partisan fight on restrictions for reducing the spread of coronavirus. We'll take one last break and then return with children's book author Laura Heiler. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. Back in April, the Emory Global Health Institute launched a contest for authors to write a children's book to explain COVID-19. The catch? They only had a couple weeks to do it. Wisconsin children's book author Laura Heiler was working on a different project when she heard about the contest, and she decided to turn a story around in just 10 days. Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imagination Runs Free follows 7-year-old Maya as she navigates life during the coronavirus pandemic. The book is intended to help children understand how they can cope, help, and find joy in this new normal. Heiler spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about what inspired her to take on this project.
So I, like everyone else, really struggling with the changes to my life caused by coronavirus. And then, of course, as a children's book author, started thinking about how children must be impacted by this when suddenly they didn't have, you know, classroom setting, they didn't have play dates, they didn't have time with their extended family members. So I became aware of a challenge created by the Emory Global Health Institute out of Atlanta. And they were encouraging authors to write a book that would help children cope. And there was a 2-week period for us to write our books.
And what did you initially think of that challenge? Was it a welcome challenge or somewhat intimidating?
Well, I have a traditional publisher and I have a 3-book contract for a middle grade series. The first book debuted in March of 2018 called The Stupendous Adventures of Mighty Marty Hayes. I was in the middle of writing book 2. When I became aware of the Emory Global Health Institute challenge and basically said, wow, I don't have time to do this. And then there were about 10 days remaining in the challenge when I decided to jump in. So I contacted my publisher, I contacted my illustrator who is based in Barbados, and we all decided to go for it. So the challenge was undertaken.
So tell us why you wanted to center this story around Maya and her family. Did this character and her world come pretty quickly and naturally to you?
It came pretty quickly. I was definitely paying attention to the changes in my neighborhood. I live in a beautiful wooded subdivision in Glendale, Wisconsin, and was listening to how the children around me were coping. So lots of different ages, and I could still hear lots of laughter. And then I would have chats with some of the older kids, middle school, high school, and they were really talking about some of the challenges with the online studying and not seeing an end in sight. They didn't know when they would get back into the classroom. So I decided to create a story of fiction, but still adhering to the safety measures that we were all following, are still all following. And I came up with 7-year-old Maya, had her 10-year-old brother Brian. The parents are working from home, and then they're separated physically from the grandparents, but they are very much still part of their lives, and they're dealing with them, talking to them via video chat. So I was hoping to create a realistic situation about what a family may be dealing with, but yet really trying to have fun with it as well.
Just as you mentioned, those images of living at home constantly surrounded by your family of all ages, virtual learning and the struggles that come with that, to Maya still trying to have a meaningful birthday party coming up. Do you think these key images will be ingrained in our brains when people look back and ask, what was the coronavirus like?
Yeah, one thing that jumped out at me as I walked around my own neighborhood, as I talked to children, was, you know, and many of us have seen this, you take walks and you see the chalk art, and people are putting together very uplifting messages. So I sort of did a take on that, played with that a little bit, and came up with a unique take on it. But it was really much thinking in terms of the kind of advice that we would have gotten from Mr. Rogers at this time, and that would have been to look to the helpers. And in my mind, I was thinking the children are very much our helpers as we go through the pandemic, because they are still having a sense of play, a lot of ingenuity as far as how they're approaching it. And I really took a lot of comfort from, you know, hearing the children's laughter in my neighborhood, seeing them keeping their day going and still just kind of getting through it. And then, of course, with the warmer weather, they are getting even more creative in their play while still social distancing. And it's just a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah. And what message did you want to convey to young children dealing with the ups and downs of suddenly living a different lifestyle as we are adjusting to the pandemic?
What I think has been fearful for children has the sense that it's out of their control, right? So they hear about the pandemic, they see the impact that it has on their family. If their family is, you know, struggling to just maintain some sort of schedule when mom and dad are working from home, or one parent is working from home, and then the parents also need to assist with online schooling, the kids are hearing the stress in their parents' voices. They're sensing the frustration, and they're feeling like there's nothing they can do. But when they are taught the proper safety measures and they're taught that they are helping to eradicate the virus, that gives them a real sense of empowerment. And it also leads to them seeing an end in sight, knowing that a vaccine is coming, knowing that school will resume one day in person again, and really starting to flourish, I think, with some of the online opportunities that have been out there. I've shared resources on my website to really let kids know that there's a lot that they can do. They can still visit places around the world like zoos and listen to authors reading their books and do a lot of things that otherwise they probably would not have thought of getting fully engaged in when they were on their regular schedule. So the key has been to you know, really equip the kids with information so that they can flourish during this time.
You wanted to reach kids that are about anywhere from 6 to 10 years old with this book. And you were kind of touching upon kids' special outlook during this period. So, and to me, it kind of shows a resiliency, you know, so are we also highlighting the resiliency that kids can hold and that you could express through the character Maya?
Oh, very much so. I think, you know, we really have to listen to kids during this time, and we may be surprised what we hear, because the kids are really asking questions based on their age level, really figuring out what they can do. And then once they feel like their questions have been answered, they're ready to go. So one of the activities that I have going on in the book is I have Maya listening to what she and her brother need to do around the house. So they need to help with disinfecting, for example. And then she comes up with an idea that the family can make masks for the community and for the neighborhood. And it really gives kids a sense of, you know, we're all in this together and we can all make this situation better if we all pitch in. And so we very much have that going on. And you can imagine a 7-year-old, how she's viewing this. But like I said, there's a lot of fun and laughter. She and her brother have a good time spending time together. They're on the very various video chats with friends and family. and coming up with creative things like, let's eat ice cream while we're talking to our grandparents. And then she is turning 8. So there's a bit of a surprise at the end of the book as to how the family decides to handle her birthday party. And so, you know, we're really just talking about, yes, kids are very resilient, and it's a matter of letting them really make some choices about how they're going to go through their day.
And not only make some choices, but acknowledging that it's okay to feel the ups and downs of this too.
Very much so. Yeah. I do deal with one or two meltdowns in the book. So a 7-year-old is going to have that. Sometimes a 10-year-old would have a meltdown as well. But it comes from a sense of frustration and they're feeling uncomfortable. And that's where that usually comes from. So again, there's a lot of reassurance that comes from both parents and her older brother. And I think that this book will be very relatable for kids who have felt some of the fear associated with the coronavirus, but also seeing just tons of signs of hope throughout the book.
On that note of families, not just here in the greater Milwaukee area, but around the world, sitting down and sharing this story together, how do you hope your book will play a part in helping kids in the future understand this moment in history, but also kids and parents get together and know how each other's feeling or to work through this together?
Yeah, I think that I'm hearing comments from adults, certainly, about how they've had time for reflection and how they were able to find some real upsides associated with spending a lot more time around their immediate family. And so I think kids are probably experiencing that as well. So I think we're seeing that probably the stress level of the family has reduced over time, and the kids are seeing that there were some really positive outcomes. So yeah, I think they will walk away after reading this book feeling very uplifted and really taking some positive measures into their future lives as they experience the new normal.
Well, Laura Heiler, thank you so much for telling us about Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imaginations Run Free. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Laura Heiler is an author from Milwaukee. Her children's book titled Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imagination Runs Free is out now. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Becca Schimmel and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor, and Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.